NASA is counting down the minutes to a crash landing on the moon, something it will engineer. In less than an hour, an unmanned spacecraft will deliberately slam onto the lunar surface, or rather into it. The impact is expected to create a huge cloud of debris that will let NASA search for signs of water. NPR science correspondent Nell Greenfield-Boyce has the details, which she is here to share with us. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's start with where exactly on the moon NASA is aiming for.
Well, the target is a crater at the south pole of the moon called Cabeus. And this is a crater where the floor is permanently shadowed. It never sees the sun. And that means it's super, super cold. And NASA thinks that water in the form of ice might be hiding in this kind of crater, even though the sunlit surface of the moon is kind of dry, like a desert. So they're doing this experiment to find out, and the mission is called LCROSS, and that stands for Lunar Crater Observation and Sensing Satellite.
And what's going to happen in those final moments leading up to the collision?
Well, actually, there's going to be two collisions. So first, an empty rocket part that weighs as much as a big SUV is going to plow into the crater, and it's going to send up a plume of dust that's going to be miles high. And the NASA spacecraft will be following closely behind that rocket part, and it's going to fly through the cloud of debris and take measurements. It'll send all the data back in real time to Earth, and the information has to come in immediately, because the spacecraft's going to crash just 4 minutes after the first impact.
You know, if this cloud of dust is miles high, will people on Earth be able to see it?
Well, not unless you've got a pretty good telescope, and you'd have to be west of the Mississippi, where it's still dark and the moon is up. But all kinds of telescopes are going to be watching this. The Hubble Space Telescope, observatories, even just like amateur astronomy clubs. Huh. It's not going to be a big spectacle. It's going to look kind of like a shimmer across the crater. But NASA is going to be broadcasting footage from the spacecraft on its website.
You know, how quickly will NASA know if it indeed kicked up ice? And in a way, why do we care if there's water there?
Well, they'll know pretty quickly. I mean, they'll have the data right away. It'll take them a couple days. And NASA says if there is water, it could be used by future explorers. But also, they just want to understand, you know, our close neighbor, whether there's actually something there that, you know, we think of as kind of an Earth thing.
You know, now there's people talking about being, kind of worried that this will hurt, this crash will hurt the moon. You on the web and whatnot, hit the man and the moon in the face. How does NASA respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, NASA's obviously sensitive to this. People love the moon, you know, this idea that we're punching it or hitting it or bombing it. But NASA says, look, you know, the moon has no atmosphere to protect it. So it's constantly being hit by incoming meteorites. You know, it's bombarded all the time. So for the moon, this is just another day. But for scientists, the impact is happening in a specific time and place that is very valuable to them. So they say it's not going to hurt the moon, but it's going to let us, you know, learn something about the moon.
Okay, so we'll be talking to you later when it finally crashes into the moon. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Some years, reporting the Nobel Prize in Physics means explaining some pretty unfamiliar stuff. Quarks, broken symmetry, magnetoresistance. Well, not so this year. With today's Nobel Prizes, the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences is celebrating tangible discoveries, things you use every day. One scientist is honored for inventing fiber optic communications, and two others got the nod for inventing the technology that is the basis of digital cameras. NPR's Richard Harris tells their stories.
Let's turn back the clock a few decades and drop in on Bell Labs in New Jersey. This is where the transistor was invented and where the laser came into being. It was a place of remarkable ideas. Willard Boyle and George Smith were part of that magical time. Smith says in October of 1969, they were trying to outsmart another part of Bell Labs to come up with a new type of computer memory.
Bill Boyle and I frequently got together to kick around ideas, and this was one of them. The actual invention took place one afternoon.
The idea, drawn on a blackboard, was a new kind of electronic circuit they called a charge-coupled device. It could work as a new kind of computer memory, but Smith realized it had a lot more potential than that.
It became immediately obvious that this device would also make a very good imaging device.
CCDs can capture light and turn it into simple electronic signals, so a visual image could be converted instantly into digital form. Digital photography was born. The military was intensely interested in this for spy satellites, and the first commercial application was for digital TV cameras. Digital still cameras lagged by quite some time, Smith says, because compact memory was still hard to come by. That is, until flash memory was invented. Smith knows this story intimately.
I had a small exploratory research department at the laboratories, about 30 people, I guess, and the flash memory was invented in my department also.
Smith and Boyle came up with dozens of inventions during their time at Bell Labs, often working together. And then, when Smith was still in his mid-50s, he simply hung up the towel.
I retired in 1986, jumped in my sailboat, sailed around the world.
And he took 17 years to do it, lingering especially long in the South Pacific with his sweetheart. Why, you might wonder, would a prolific and highly successful inventor just call it quits?
If one is honest about it, as you grow older, your inventive abilities deteriorate. I have run into many people at Bell Labs when they were younger who were really great, and then they sort of went downhill, even though they didn't admit it.
These days, Bell Labs is no longer seen as a place of unfettered creativity. But Smith and Boyle can see for themselves how their inventions changed the world. CCDs are not just in cameras, they are in satellites, medical devices, and notably, telescopes. Peter Stockman at the Space Telescope Science Institute says they have revolutionized astronomy.
Practically anything in the last 30 years would have been essentially impossible without CCDs.
Hubble's incredible images are captured on CCDs, and so are the images taken by telescopes all around the world. CCDs helped astronomers study the black holes that lie at the heart of galaxies and measure the age of the universe. And now Willard Boyle and George Smith can add a punctuation mark to their careers, the Nobel Prize. Smith is still trying to find the words to describe it all.
Well, when I wake up, I'll let you know.
George Smith and Willard Boyle share half of the $1.4 million prize. The other half goes to Charles Kao, who revolutionized global communications with his work in fiber optics. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Now, time to hear from three scientists who discovered this morning they had won the Nobel Prize in physiology or medicine. As NPR's John Hamilton reports, they won for explaining a biological process that seems to play an important role in cancer and aging.
When cells divide, they lose a tiny bit of genetic information at the end of each chromosome.
The ends of chromosomes are always wearing down.
Elizabeth Blackburn from the University of California, San Francisco, is one of the scientists who became a Nobel winner today. Blackburn says the ends of chromosomes would eventually get worn away if they weren't protected by something called a telomere. She says it acts like the plastic tip on a shoelace, which prevents the lace end from fraying. But where do telomeres come from? That's what Blackburn was trying to figure out in the 1980s when she was at UC Berkeley. She figured there must be an enzyme responsible for making and maintaining these genetic shoelace tips.
There were some hints, and then I think there was a particular time when we really saw a particular piece of evidence there which said very strongly to us, this thing really does exist.
The discovery was made by Carol Greider, who was a graduate student back then. These days, Greider is a professor at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. She also will receive a share of the Nobel Prize.
We were studying these single-celled pond animals called Tetrahymena that happen to have 40,000 chromosomes. And we figured if you want to understand how chromosomes are replicated and how telomeres work, go to the organism that has 40,000 of them.
What Greider found in those organisms was an enzyme that was able to keep the ends of chromosomes in good shape. She says at first they called the enzyme telomere terminal transferase.
But we realized, especially because we were working with this organism that was called Tetrahymena thermophila, that if you want to say Tetrahymena thermophila telomere terminal transferase, that gets to be a mouthful.
So Greider took a friend's suggestion and renamed the enzyme telomerase. At the time, it wasn't clear whether the system worked the same way in other species. That question was answered by Jack Szostek, a geneticist at Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital. He's the third recipient of today's Nobel Prize. Szostek took the telomere DNA from the organism Blackburn and Greider were studying and inserted it into yeast cells. He then used X-ray images to see whether the DNA was protecting yeast chromosomes during cell division.
There was a moment when, in sort of developing the X-ray film where, just by looking at it, it was obvious that the experiment had worked and that therefore the telomere machinery was working in yeast.
That suggested the machinery would be present in all species, including humans. More recent research has confirmed that. Shostak says that when he and other scientists made those early discoveries, they were just trying to understand how cells work. But since then, it's become clear that the process they uncovered offers a new way to understand a wide range of diseases, including cancer. Shostak says cancer cells depend on telomerase. He says it seems to allow them to divide like crazy without dying the way normal cells would.
The hope is that by interfering with the enzyme, maybe there'll be a therapeutically useful benefit.
Elizabeth Blackburn from UC San Francisco says telomeres also seem to have a role in things like heart disease, diabetes, and perhaps even the aging process itself. Blackburn's recent work suggests that chronic psychological stress can actually damage telomeres. John Hamilton, NPR News.
And next, we can finally tell you that there is a way to get something for nothing. Say something happens in your backyard that needs attention, and without lifting a finger, without even noticing, mysteriously, it's taken care of for free. NPR science correspondent Robert Krulwich has the details.
It begins with a, kind of a thwack against your kitchen window or the wall of your house. So you step outside, and there, lying in the grass, is a little bird. And when you lean over and you look closely, you see it's dead. So you look away. And then maybe a day, 2 days later, you pass by that very spot on your lawn, and the corpse is gone.
Mm-hmm.
Totally gone.
Yeah.
And you didn't move it. So where did it go? Well, one possibility, says Professor Bernd Heinrich at the University of Vermont, is you have just received the services of a very remarkable pair of beetles.
Well, they are burying beetles. They are the undertakers of the small animals in the forest, the little birds and mice, rodents.
So if I'm a bird lying dead on a lawn, they would know that I'm there?
Yeah, very shortly after you die, you're going to emit some scent that they can smell apparently for miles.
And because natural recycling is a very competitive business,
they have to get there before the flies can get it, before a raccoon or crow or raven picks it up. So they work very fast.
And these flying beetles are big are they?
You know, as big as a big bumblebee.
Which is not very big if you're trying to hoist a dead starling or a dead mouse on your back and lug it off to soft ground. But when these beetles, and it's a family business, it's a mom-and-pop kind of arrangement, when they get you where they want you, they start to dig.
They bury you. They start digging underneath you, removing the dirt and throwing it to the sides until gradually you start to sink down.
So how long does it take them to bury a whole bird?
You know, in a night, and you're buried totally.
Then, says Professor Heinrich, in a kind of, I'm not quite sure how to put this, in a sort of happy moment, the two beetles will mate,
yeah,
which produces beetle babies safely underground.
And they build a little nest for the larvae.
Mm-hmm. And then the parents munch on the bird or on the mouse, and they chew the food on behalf of their children.
The young actually beg. They are sort of analogous to birds, to a pair of birds feeding their young.
And after a few days, those babies mature, and they become flying beetles, and they take off refueled with bits of mouse or bird, and they rejoin the neighborhood.
Yes. Yes.
And it's just this kind of finish, says Professor Heinrich, dying and then being scattered up and about everywhere that he wants when he dies. No tight coffin for me, he says.
You know, being sealed up, totally removed from all the natural processes that normally occur with every animal on Earth is very somehow frightening. It seems unnatural.
But I think don't most people find that being eaten is the thing that's frightening and a little I don't want to get eaten by a beetle.
No, I don't find that frightening at all. Hmm. I find that comforting to be part of the ecosystem.
And he's not alone. There's an old Lee Hayes song sung by the great Pete Seeger.
If I should die before I wake, all my bone and sinew take. Put me in the compost pile, decompose me for a while.
You laugh, but, you know, there are a lot of people who hate the idea of being decomposed. So,
well, yeah, I don't think it's decompose that's the emphasis here. It's the grow and the compose, to be composed into grass, to be composed into ravens, to be composed into flowers and trees. You know, that's a comforting thought to me.
But it's not like you're looking forward to the idea, though.
Well, I don't really relish being eaten, anything like that. I think it's just part of the cost and giving back. I realize I have killed untold hundreds of thousands to live. All of us have, because we all live off other life. And just to remove ourselves totally so that nobody else can feed on us, just somehow it seems sacrilegious to me.
All that I am will feed the trees and little fishies in the seas. When radishes and corn you munch, you may be having me for lunch.
But when you choose to be buried in a tight coffin, says Professor Heinrich, you do lock yourself off from the trees and the animals that you know and the critters that you've lived with.
Worms, water, sun will have their way.
Why not share returning yourself with the world that you know, he asks.
I find that comforting to be part of the ecosystem.
And then excrete me with a grin, chortling, there goes Lee again.
It's not everybody's way to get buried, but it is right. One way. Robert Krulwich, NPR News.
And if all this has you thinking about other burial ideas, Robert Krulwich has an even wilder one for you, the freeze, shatter, and sprinkle option. You can hear about that and other fascinating human and animal rituals at NPR.org.
I don't want to talk about things we've gone through, though it's hurting me. Now it's history. I've played all my cards, and that's what you've done too. Nothing more to say, no more ace to play. The winner takes it all, the loser standing small beside the victory.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences today put the spotlight on ribosomes and on three scientists. Two U.S. citizens and one Israeli have won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce has this story on the scientists and their work.
Today started out with a little bad luck for Venki Ramakrishnan. He was bicycling to his job at the MRC Laboratory of Molecular Biology in Cambridge, England.
I came to work late because I had a flat tire, and I was just getting settled in, and the phone rang, and I thought, you know, I have a lot of friends who play practical jokes.
And this had to be one of those elaborate jokes, because the voice said the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences was on the line. That's what you normally hear when you're about to be told you've won the Nobel Prize.
I said, well, you have a very good Swedish accent, but, you know, I have no idea who you are.
Eventually, they convinced him it was for real. Ramakrishnan was sharing the chemistry prize with two other researchers, Ada Yonat of the Weizmann Institute of Science in Israel and Thomas Steitz of Yale University. The prize recognizes their work on ribosomes, the protein-making factories of living cells. Your body contains tens of thousands of different proteins. The recipe for each protein is encoded in the DNA of every cell. What the ribosome does is read the recipe and, like a cook, put together the right chemical pieces to make specific proteins. For a long time, scientists have wanted to understand exactly how this all happens. And for that, they would need to map the exact structure of the ribosome. That's what was done by the three scientists honored with this year's Nobel. They used a technique called X-ray crystallography to map the position of every one of the hundreds of thousands of atoms in a ribosome. This is something that was long thought to be a hopeless dream.
I was skeptical myself.
Thomas Cech is a molecular biologist at the University of Colorado at Boulder, who won his own Nobel Prize in chemistry 20 years ago. He says it's hard to express just how complex the ribosome is compared to other biochemical structures scientists have studied in the past.
Just imagine someone who had spent their life looking at ditches, and then all of a sudden you get a glimpse of the Grand Canyon.
So he says the three researchers definitely deserved the Nobel. Although Venki Ramakrishnan says it feels strange that the prize he won is just limited to three people.
I mean, science is now done by massive groups of people. Even each of us have, you know, many talented people in our labs who make critical contributions.
One practical application of knowing the ribosome structure is that it could be useful for medicine. Many antibiotics actually kill bacteria by blocking the normal function of the germ's ribosomes. So having the complete structure of the ribosome could help scientists develop new antibiotics. One of this year's Nobel winners, Thomas Steitz, actually helped co-found a pharmaceutical company to design alternative antibiotics for drug-resistant infections.
And that is looking like it's going to be very successful.
I asked him how he thought winning the Nobel Prize would change his life.
Well, to be honest, I hope it doesn't.
Do you think you're going to go to work tomorrow?
Absolutely. I have to write a grant application. It's due very shortly.
In fact, he says, working on that application is what he had been planning to do today. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
We're going to hear now from someone whose life and work has been transformed by these Nobel Prize-winning scientists. Annie Griffiths-Belt is a photographer for National Geographic. She's taken photos, digital photos, all over the world, and she sent them home high speed thanks to fiber optic cables. Annie Griffiths-Belt joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
When did you make this transition to digital? Do you still have memories of walking across that line to the brave new world?
I have very clear memories of walking into the digital world because photographers are like most people. We're reluctant to change things, and I had an intimate relationship with film for 25 years. But about 5 years ago, I started making the switch because it was clear it was coming like a freight train, and anybody who wanted to continue to work it better get on board.
You say coming like a freight train. I take this was not just a gradual transition. It was more like an earthquake.
It was like an earthquake. In fact, I remember sitting at a photographic seminar at National Geographic when we as a group, the photographers, were presented with this new reality. And there were a lot of crossed arms and crossed eyebrows because people who have been doing something the same way for years were skeptical first and then terrified. 2 years later, it was pretty much everybody was digital.
And has it been liberating? I imagine that sort of from a logistical point of view, it must make things much easier.
It does. I mean, it has been liberating in ways I couldn't possibly have imagined. For example, when I'm working in very remote parts of the world, I can, you know, get home, download things, and send them via email, pictures of themselves. And so in addition to taking the photograph, you can give something back.
I'm wondering, though, if there's a but there. It's been liberating, but. I'm wondering if you lose some control because you're not necessarily processing the images yourself in a darkroom. And from what I understand, the printmaking process used to be a great source of pride for photographers.
Oh, the printmaking was a great source of pride and a great source of community, too. I mean, I really think the loss of the darkroom is a big loss. It, you know, that was the gathering spot where people would look over each other's shoulders and look at their images and give feedback. And there is a loss of control in that this digital information can be interpreted in so many different ways by someone who doesn't have that print or that transparency to look at to make sure that they're reproducing it accurately.
Can you describe for us a moment where digital technology and the ability to transfer those pictures via high-speed fiber optics cable hit home for you?
Oh, yeah. I remember specifically an image that I took on the top of Victoria Falls, where a piece of land emerged only at very, very low times in the river. So I went out with these wonderful guys, local guys, who would go out there and swim, actually, in a swimming hole at the top of Victoria Falls. As we were about to leave, the sun was setting, and I turned around, and one of the guys was standing at the edge of the falls with this kind of spiritual body language. I remember trying to get the shot quickly, and then there was this sort of unbelievable feeling of that evening having it and sending it to the editor. You know, one of the most beautiful, privileged photos I've ever taken, and it was in front of the editor that evening, and that was extraordinary to me.
It sounds sublime. I wonder if you could go in your files and send it off to us via fiber optic cables, and we could post it on the web so our listeners could take a look at it.
Oh, sure, I can. Absolutely, no problem.
Well, Annie Griffiths-Belt, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
All the best to you.
You too. Bye-bye.
And sure enough, soon after we talk, Annie Griffiths-Belt sent us that photo from Victoria Falls within minutes. I'm looking at it now on the website. It is sublime. You can see it, too, at npr.org.